The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs, a broadcast that examines our ever-changing world through the lens of the United States Constitution. Douglas V. Gibbs is on the air.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Our records indicate you've been lied to. Welcome to the truth, Douglas V. Gibbs.
All I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
Welcome, my friends. Douglas V. Gibbs here, Mr. Constitution. I had to do a replay last week. I had bronchitis. You can still probably hear it in my voice a little bit, but we're on the air again this week. And I got to thinking about just things in general, and I came up with this thought. We have seen this great flip. A giant flip from what we were to where we are. So welcome to the show, Mr. Constitution Hour. My name is Douglas V. Gibbs, douglasvgibbs.com. And here on K-Praise and these podcast channels that you listen to the show on, I go through various things that have to do with Christianity, the Constitution, political news, things like that. This is a Christian station. I am a constitutionalist, so I try to keep those two a part of the discussion. And I was thinking about from the very beginning how there's been a great flip, a great change. We've gone from one thing to another. We've gone from, constitutional to unconstitutional, of course, but what does that mean? And so I decided this morning just to make a list of those things, what we've gone from and to. So far, I'm up to 106. And I could go through the whole list. I'll go through some of them because I want to just talk about how we've changed over the years. And it's an amazing thing, to be honest with you. So let's kind of go through some of these things that I've come up with tonight on Mr. Constitution Hour here on KPRZ, KPRZ.com, or on your favorite podcast channel if you're listening that way to Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs. So number one, from virtuous liberty to a culture of woke. Someone asked me one time, I said, well, Doug, what is the definition of woke? It was a lefty, just trying to confuse me or get me to say something like, well, it's immorality or something like that. And the culture of woke is cultural Marxism or cultural communism, if you want to call it that. That's what collectivism, communism, the left does, is they got to create the chaos so they could tear down the system and then reestablish it the way they want it. So, China went through this. Well, the men are demasculized. The culture is torn apart. Fundamental foundations are destroyed. And you go from what was a fundamental, foundational, traditional system to a new modern construct of whatever the Marxists want it to be. And more often than not, it creates chaos and a need for some type of control. And it's based on the Hegelian dialectic. The Hegelian dialectic comes from a guy named George William Friedrich Hegel, I think is the name. But anyway, Hegel was the guy that Karl Marx studied. And Hegel basically said that if you're going to tear apart a system, there's a three-step process. First, you create a problem. You create an opposition to the problem. Then you create the solution to the problem. And you guide the whole thing, and you do it to create confusion and all this other stuff. So a great example, I think a perfect example for it is you create the problem, racism. You create the opposition to the problem, Black Lives Matter. Then you create the solution. And with all the chaos going on, government interference, and government's got to make sure everybody's equal and inclusive and so on and so forth. So that's, and now when I say virtuous liberty to a culture of woke, so virtuous liberty, now this takes us back to Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin, one of my favorite quotes by him was about a virtuous society. And he said, only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters. So when you lose your virtue, when there's no moral standard, and it becomes anything goes, then corruption, viciousness, and so on and so forth, that sets in. And you lose your freedom because you become enslaved by, you know, the sin, the problems. And when people are doing whatever they want, then there's clashes and there's, you know, people in disagreement. You've got a clash of rights and so on and so forth. So then the jackboots have to come in to take control and, you know, crack the whip and swing the baton or whatever it is they're going to do. And that's basically what he's saying. So if you go from virtuous liberty, where people are virtuous, they understand right and wrong, they operate in that manner, they follow the law because it's the right thing to do, to that there's practically no law because, you know, everything is topsy-turvy. We're not worried about right and wrong because, hey man, whatever you feel at the moment. So there is no moral standard, there is no absolute, and so you've got chaos that it winds up ensuing, and you wind up in a sense, a cultural prison. So we've gone from virtuous liberty to a culture of woe, which is really coming a culture of authoritarianism and a culture of bondage. It goes back to Tytler's cycle, and for those of you who've heard me talk about it, you know, it's a fascinating thing. If you haven't heard it, look it up. Tytler cycle, T-Y-T-L-E-R cycle, Tytler cycle, Alexander Tytler, and he came up with this idea that there's a series of events that happens. It wasn't a cycle then. It was turned into a cycle by a military speaker, and I think it was the late 1940s, early 1950s, general giving a speech, and he was talking about Alexander Tytler's series of events that happen that changes a system of liberty from bondage to, and in the series goes from bondage to spiritual awakening to courage to liberty, and then from liberty to abundance and prosperity, then from abundance and prosperity to selfishness, from selfishness to apathy, complacency, dependency on government, and ultimately back to bondage. And this series is supposed to last about 200 years, maybe 250. And so we're approaching 250 now. So we're definitely at the outside limits of what Alexander Tytler said a system should last. And so this is what we're watching. You go from a virtuous society, this spiritual awakening, all the way around to, you know, dependence on the government and back to bondage. And the culture of woke is taking us there. All right, so number two on my list is from localism to centralized authoritarianism. Back in the beginning, you know, it was local communities, and the communities took care of each other. And it's funny because the left will tell you they're all about community. And that what they mean is community through government control and through government standards and through government organization. They don't mean really, truly community. But when America was young and it was coming up, you know, you had these communities, and these communities took care of each other, and realized that back then the communities weren't like it is now, where you've got city upon city upon city upon city, and you got this, you know, federal highway that connects it and all that jazz. Yeah, you know, if you had a community and you had your little houses in a circle or whatever, and you were surrounded by trees, and it may be a day's ride on a horse to the next community. And so the communities took care of their own business. And even when the United States was formed as a country, the states kept their sovereignty, and the communities hung onto their sovereignty. Local issues were taken care of at the local level. Localism. You know, shouldn't take an act of Congress to decide whether or not to put a stop sign. There's local issues, and you have, you know, issues that are for the country that the federal government is supposed to take care of, like your securing the border, trade with other countries, maritime law, war, and other foreign affairs, and mediation between the states. Because what was happening back then is the states fought like cats and dogs, and who was to take care of the fighting? Because the state courts were going to side with their state. So the federal government was to be used as a mediator, a neutral arbitrator, so to speak, between the states. And this is where the domestic tranquility comes in, from the preamble of the Constitution, if ever you've read it. So that was localism. And local, you know, local affairs are taken care of by local government, and then the things for the country and mediation disputes between the states were taken care of by the federal government. Now what we've gone from that localism to centralized authoritarianism, the federal government runs everything. And even if they don't run it, they've got a hand in it somehow. And they're telling these cities that, you know, in these regions that, you know, you've got certain laws that you have to abide by, federal zoning and federal mineral rights and federal this and federal that, and you get a federal permit, and then the states are pushing things that the federal government and really a globalistic agenda is pushing. Especially when it comes to redevelopment plans and, you know, goal high density housing and things like that. And so we've gone from the localism to centralized authoritarianism. All right, so number three on my list is congressional coin to the Federal Reserve. In the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, it says that it's the authority of Congress to coin money and to regulate the value thereof. It does not say that Congress is supposed to give it away to somebody else to take care of the formation of the money in our system. This was something that was challenged very early. So while the states are supposed to, when the Congress is supposed to coin money, and when Congress is coining money, what does that mean? It means that the banks are not coining the money. You wanted to keep the banks out of that. You wanted the government to handle its own money, create its own money, not borrow it through a central bank like a Federal Reserve. But the Bank of the United States, our first central bank, emerged in 1791, only 2 years after the Constitution took effect. So you can see that this, you had local banking with local banks, and the Congress was issuing the money. Now you have a Federal Reserve, and now what we're pushing for is a worldwide digital currency. And what that does is that allows centralized control by a larger entity. Instead of allowing the money and the free market to self-regulate the system. When you have a system like we have now with the Federal Reserve, where you're borrowing the money and then they're regulating the value of the currency by how much they put in the system and things like that, you find yourself under centralized authoritarianism. You find yourself under a worldwide rule, and that's essentially what is happening. All right, so number four, from local armed militias to federal militarized agencies. Now, in Article 1, Section 8, what it says is that to execute the laws of the Union has to go through the militias. The militia is the local military kind of pseudo-military type unit, state defense force, but they are also your local people who are working with, you know, your government agencies, things like that. And what we have now is we have these federal militarized agencies, your FBI and your IRS now is armed. Well, you go back to the Whiskey Rebellion, and when the tax collector showed up, he wasn't armed, he was alone. And when they refused to pay the tax, you know, he sends back word, says, hey, they're not paying the tax. So they didn't send an armed, you know, Whiskey Revenue Service. Washington administration, well, actually, Washington decided to come down by himself, but he was accompanied by militiamen. The militiamen were there to help him execute that local law. Now, understand that domestic laws are going to be at a minimum when it comes to federal government because they don't have very many constitutional authorities for domestic anything. The federal government wasn't created for domestic. It was created for the Union, to preserve the Union, to promote the Union, to protect the Union. So it's going to be foreign affairs. It's going to be foreign defense. It's going to be trade with other countries. It's going to be the dispute between the states, stuff like that. And so for the handful or few domestic laws that federal government is going to have to execute, there was not supposed to be some militarized agency. There might be federal personnel, but the agency or the entity that was to carry it out, to execute it, was the militias. So now what we have is, like I said, we've got an FBI that we're supposed to be afraid of, IRS agents that are armed, and a federal apparatus that is, for lack of a better way of saying it, an authoritarian force that will shoot if necessary to get their way. All right, number five, from law and order to defunded police. Law and order is an interesting thing because it gets back to the very beginning, virtuous liberty. If you have a virtuous society, law and order is easy because people are virtuous. They're going to do the right thing. They know the rules. They know the laws. Consent to the governed. You know, we know this is the law, and except for extreme cases where some people either go against the law or they are a habitual lawbreaker, you're going to have a society that, for the large part, follows the law. And that creates law and order in an orderly society. And so when you have a virtuous society, you typically have an orderly society. Now, you do have police, and you do have them armed, and you have a punishment that is in place, because there are going to be those. They're going to break the law, and they're going to do things that are not within the standards of this orderly society. And so that's what you have. But what we've got now is we're defunding these police, and we're acting like, well, the criminalities is okay or something, or it's a minor deal, and these cops should be social workers instead. And now what you've got is you got law and order breaking down. Why? Because not just because you're defunding police and you're taking away authorities from these police agencies. And I get it. There's people who say, well, yeah, but Doug, you know, the cops are all messed up. So, well, some of them, that is the case. Absolutely. Whenever you have human beings in anything, there's going to be the bad, there's going to be the good. So do you have bad cops? Sure you do. You got good cops. But my point is not the cops. My point is the society. There will be no law and order if the society is debauched. And then as the society becomes more debauched, they have more need of masters, but you're defunding the police. So the very arm that would prevent the problems of a debauched society, you're saying, or we've got the left saying, defund and let's, you know, make them a bunch of social workers. And you guys robbing a liquor store isn't going to be talked down because a social worker shows up and says, now think about this. Now, do you think this is good for you? No, he's there to rob the bank. He's there to rob the liquor store or whatever, because that's what he does. He's a bad guy. And there needs to be a policing agency to stop that. But if there's a virtuous society, there's not going to be very many of them, but they'll be out there, because that's what bad people do. Bad people exist. All right, from small farm, this is number six, from small farms to large foreign corporate control. And this kind of goes bigger than I kind of expected. I was watching a video just recently about how in the state of Oregon, what they've decided to do is water in Oregon is considered everybody. It belongs to the people. Therefore, if you're going to use the water for anything other than sole personal use, you have to get a permit. And when it comes to contained animal units, where you have an animal contained in the unit, there's concrete or there's gravel or something like that, and you know, of course, there's going to be feces. And so in order to keep the water from the waste from the animals getting down into the water table below and all that, Oregon requires you to have equipment and things like that to ensure that that doesn't dirty the water table or dirty the water. But the equipment and what's expected is so expensive and such a big deal that really only the large corporations can afford it. So what it's doing is it's killing the small farms. The small farms who have, you know, a couple of milking cows and half a dozen, you know, egg-laying hens are not going to be able to put up the money for the infrastructure of materials, of machines, or whatever it is that the state's requiring to protect the precious water table. So they're killing the small farms, and what does that do when you kill the small farms? The larger farms survive because they can afford it, and now they're happy because they have less competition from the small farms. And then on top of that, we've got, you know, foreign entities like China buying up land, buying up farmland. So the small farms are dying and large foreign corporations are really in control, and they're, you know, under, and they are being controlled by foreign interests like China. So that's what we're seeing going on. We've gone from small farms where, you know, gosh, they might take their crop to the farmer's market or something. You don't see that in a lot of places anymore. And what you're seeing is an emergence of these large foreign corporate farming systems. And then even then, that's being done away with because, as Klaus Schwab has got us, you know, believing, and what's his name from Microsoft, you've got, we're going to make your food. We're going to scientifically make it. It's going to be manufactured. You're going to have this genetically grown in a tube, you know, meat and vegetables or something like that. And that's what they're moving towards. And that's also large foreign corporate control. The small farms are dying and it's going to large foreign corporate control. But don't worry, they'll feed you something that'll keep you alive. Probably not for very long, but you know, hey, you know, you'll own nothing to be happy, I guess, as Klaus Schwab once said. All right, number seven, from local roadways to the Department of Transportation. The Department of Transportation, the federal Department of Transportation, is not constitutional. Now, if all they did as a transportation department is they made a few reports just to help people do things the right way and all sort of stuff, but ultimately the control, the lawmaking regarding all of this was up in the states, then it would be a constitutional endeavor. But it's not. The Department of Transportation is a authoritarian ruling regulatory department that dictates federal law that's not even supposed to exist in the first place. It's nothing the Constitution that tells the federal government. It can tell us how much air we have in our tires and where our roadway is going to be and what the emission standards should be and all that. It's none of the federal government's business. Am I saying that there should be no emission standards? No, if a state wants to do that, then that's fine from a legal standpoint. But the federal government's not supposed to have that kind of say. They're not supposed to be involved. The Department of Transportation is not supposed to exist. There's no authority for it. Simple as that. All right, so let's get to number 8, from little red schoolhouses to public training centers. Oh, that sounds like fun, don't it? So Thomas Jefferson did believe in public schools, funded schools, things like that, but he did not believe that the federal government had any business being involved. There's no authority. There's no authority in the Constitution for the federal government to have any involvement in education. And so what Jefferson suggested was that the funding would come from the states, but the curriculum and the hiring of the teachers and all that would be done locally by those who were most affected by education, the parents of the children. And so what happened was over the frontier and throughout America, schools began to emerge. But for the large part, except for in the cities, they were these little red schoolhouses, and the community would hire a teacher to come teach the kids, and they would closely monitor it, and they would choose the curriculum, and they'd be know what their children are being taught, and so on and so forth. And that is how America was among the top educated societies in the world. We scored higher on tests with little red schoolhouses. We became the greatest country in the world teaching our kids in little red schoolhouses. It kind of reminds me of the school I teach at right now. It's a homeschool, away from home kind of thing. It's a private school. It's set up like a private school. I have a classroom, the whole bit. I teach U.S. history this year. I've taught government and economics, things like that in the past. But this year and last year, my teaching has been U.S. history. And it is small classrooms, and the parents are very involved, and the teachers may or may not have credentials. They're teaching a curriculum that is accepted by the school and the parents are choosing that, and they appreciate that, and they don't want, the woke stuff coming in. And so we don't even talk about, any of this garbage that's going on. It's all about teaching the kids reading, writing, arithmetic, and the basics of, what they need to know. And it does a great job. These kids do great. I've had parents kids that they had pulled out of public school to put into our school tell me how their child is a different child since coming to this school and being in this environment. That they're more interested in learning, that they try harder, it's better for them. And that's kind of what the little red schoolhouses were. You got, parental involvement, and you've got basic education without all of the ideological insertions from, various directions. What we have now is we have public school system. They're really public training centers. They're not there to teach you how to think. They're there to teach you what to think. And they've got the kids convinced that, socialism is the next great thing. And down with capitalism. They sound like great little Soviet communists. And that's what we've got. We've got public training centers, indoctrination centers, centers where the kids are being taught to reject their families, reject tradition, reject a moral standard. And what we have is declining test scores and declining education system. And then on top of that, there's no discipline. And so now you've got, metal detectors and fights and a bunch of thuggery and all this other garbage that goes on at these schools. And so number 8, from little red schoolhouses to public training centers, that's how the great flip has happened in that. And then number 9, we've gone from disciplined children to child protection and affirmation. Used to be the parents had the say, it was total say, and if you didn't like it, you got the belt as a child, or you got whatever other punishment you had coming to you. And the biblical concept of honoring thy father and mother was a big deal. Parents have lost that grip, lost that control. And, it's not just a societal problem. It's not just being caused by the wokeism and being caused by an education system and entertainment and all that jazz, but also the parents have kind of thrown their hands up. Or it takes two to work and they don't have time. I know when I was raising my kids, I had, because I worked sometimes 2 and 3 jobs, I had very little time, and my wife pretty much did everything when it came to the nurturing of the children, and that's kind of the way I was raised anyway. The man doesn't nurture, the man puts the food on the table and, you know, works his rear off and then sleeps in the recliner at night and then goes back to work next morning, and the homework and the nurturing and all of that jazz really comes from mom. You know, and I know in today's day and age, there's been some changes in those dynamics. I get it. But what we've seen is that discipline that children had, the honor thy father and mother, the getting the spank and all that, that's gone. Not only because our society and our culture has moved away from it, but because we have been pushed by a political narrative that parents don't have rights over their children, and that discipline is somehow now, especially corporal punishment, spankings and things like that. Well, that's why that's abusive. And now it's even gotten to the point where you do what your child gets, do whatever they want, be whatever they want, be how they want to be. And if you disagree with their little ideas, and then let's say they decide, you know what? Gosh, I don't know if I want to be a boy or a girl anymore. I want to be. And if you don't agree with that, the state could take your children from you. In fact, there's a case that was just turned down by the Supreme Court. I think it was from Illinois or Indiana, where the kids were taken away from the parents because they refused to adhere to the gender affirmation, the gender decision of the child. And so that's okay. Well, that's child abuse. We're taking children away from you. You agree with your child. The parents have no say. The parents aren't the adult in the room. Apparently the child is. If the child decides they're not even sure if they should have certain equipment in their underwear, then the parent is abusive for not, you know, bending over backwards to accept that ridiculous idea. And so we have literally destroyed disciplined children, and we've gone from that to child protection and affirmation. And, you know, I mean, I've always argued the CPA and the IRS, the Child Protective Agency and the Internal Revenue Service, act above the law. It's not innocent until proven guilty. It's, hey, you know, we think you did this, or your neighbor said that, or so we're taking your kids. You're guilty until you prove your innocence. It's completely the opposite of what our system's supposed to be about. And that's what we're operating under. That's what we're living under. And so I'm watching this go on, and it's created a situation where the kids now rule. The parents are afraid of the children. The teachers are afraid of the children. And the children, who are too young to know right from wrong and left from right and up from down, and apparently anymore, boy from girl, because they've been taught this junk by a cultural Marxist, you know, narrative that's in the schools and other and in the entertainment industry and in the news and everything else. So you've lost the discipline. You don't have children that honor their parents because they've been taught that, you know, the state will protect them. The state is there to make sure they get whatever they want. Just throw the temper tantrum loud enough. Just scream and yell and scream and yell over your parents until the state comes in and says, hey, parent, you're the problem. I mean, that's what's going on here. And we have, you know, a whole system now where parents have lost control. Parents are not being honored by their children. And, you know, parents throw their hands up and say, okay, well, then I'm out of it. If I'm not going to be even listened to, then why do I even try? And then the state grabs full control, and now you've got a new society of good little obedient socialists following behind their overlords in the leftist governmental system. So that was number 9. Number 10, from foreign relations to global entanglements. It used, you know, it's funny because George Washington in his farewell address explained how, you know, foreign entanglements is not something that we should be getting our, you know, getting into. If it doesn't directly influence the United States, if there is not a direct interest, a direct influence, or we were not directly attacked, then the foreign issue is none of our business. If it's not a trading partner, it's not regarding us directly, then stay out of it. It's a foreign, you know, it's a foreign entanglement, and just stay out of it. But we've gone from foreign relations and staying out of these foreign entanglements to global entanglements, where our hand is in every single cookie jar. We're in Ukraine, we're here, we're there. Now, I get it. We have our allies. For example, with Israel, that's one of our allies. And, you know, if Hamas is a problem, we should be there for Israel. But, you know, that doesn't mean that you also spend the entire, you know, all of your lunch money so that you have nothing left for your foreign ally at the same time. And it doesn't mean that we should have our hands and everything. We're not the global police force. We're not the entity that should be sticking our hands into every single cookie jar. We shouldn't be in Ukraine, for example. It doesn't directly affect us. They're not a NATO member. And this is a war that's been going on between these peoples of the Russian and Ukrainian creation of the United States. And it costs us money, and it's also a power grab, and it's an influence peddling operation. I mean, there's so much more to it. And so we've gone from foreign relations to global entanglements, and our leftist overlords would love it, because what it does, it makes everything an emergency, and as long as everything's an emergency, then they have emergency powers. As long as they have emergency powers, they can disregard the Constitution, do whatever the heck they want, because, you know, hey, it's an emergency. All right, so let's go to number 11, from small town doctors to healthcare systems. You know, and that's actually a big deal. I remember when I was a kid watching shows, and this, I don't remember this being the case in my world, but in my parents' world, especially my grandparents' world, I remember my grandparents talking about it, and you would have a small town doctor, and the doctor would make house calls, and the doctor would do everything he could to make sure that he worked with all of his patients, he kept the price down, the quality up. And when there was other doctors in town, they would compete for business, and they would keep the prices down and the quality up, and they would do things that were, you know, go out of the way, like house calls. And then in the 1930s, you had something called health insurance kind of emerge, and it became law by the, you know, late 40s, 50s, that all companies had to offer that benefit. And before you knew it, we stopped being a free market when it came to health care, and we became an insurance market. Free market to insurance market. And so now, instead of having small town doctors that are competing for your business in a free market, you got giant corporations competing for your subscription dollars and with giant healthcare systems. And that creates a problem, because now the prices go through the roof. What do they care what they're charging? You know, the insurance companies have deep pockets. And then you've got this other problem with the legal part of it, where you don't have a good legal system here, and doctors get sued all the time, and you know, they're worried about malpractice, you know, lawsuits, and they have malpractice insurance, all sort of stuff. So for fear of getting sued, they apply every test, and they apply every little deal going on here, so they can cover every single base. What do they care how much it's going to cost you? The insurance is paying for it. So they can't say, well, gosh, you know, this could be expensive, you know, but we can keep it down if you just do this. But understand, if we just do this, we could miss that. The patient says, okay, I understand that. Here, you want me to sign something? Okay, yeah, that'd be great. And there's no malpractice, because the warning was given and it was understood that it was about making sure that the healthcare stayed reasonably priced for the patient. But now with these insurances, it's like, you know what, we're not even going to ask. We're just going to, you know, do every single test. We're going to do every single little action, so we make sure we don't get hit with malpractice, and the cost goes through the roof, and no average person can pay for it. But don't worry, you've got insurance. And the insurance is like, don't worry, they're paying payments, and you're going, man, these payments are out of control. I almost wish it was a free market again. And that's what's going on. We've gone from small town doctors to healthcare systems, and it's been destructive. All right, number 12, from the rule of law to social justice. And this kind of goes back to Benjamin Franklin. So remember, Benjamin Franklin said, you know, that that virtuous society, right, from virtue, only a virtuous people, should I say. He didn't say virtuous society in this, I mean, that's the way I like to term it, but what he said is only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. So in other words, if you're a virtuous people, you're going to follow the rule of law. You know what the rule of law is. What is the rule of law? The rule of law is natural law. It is the natural order of things. It is a natural understanding that it's not right to go up to someone and slap them upside the head. We know this. It's the rule of law. Rule of law, we're not supposed to act unethically. We're not supposed to take advantage. We're not supposed to break the law. And we know this. And if you're a virtuous society, you follow that rule of law. But what happens is the rule of man starts to take over. Social justice and, you know, make people happy and all sort of stuff. And I don't know if you're familiar with the story in the Bible when Moses goes up to get the Ten Commandments. And the rule of law was based on God's law. And that's the same today. And the people decide now they don't want to follow the rule of law while Moses is gone. So they decide to melt down all their gold stuff, and they fashion it into a golden calf, and they start to worship the golden calf and kind of start having their own rules that were outside the rule of law, and they're having all kinds of parties and doing things that are outside the moral standard. Moses comes back down. He's like, what's going on here? and it's chaos, you know? So that's the story about the golden calf and all. And so what I tell people to help them understand the rule of law in our own society is this. I say, when we abandon the rule of law and we embrace the rule of man, which is what is happening with the woke stuff and all that, it doesn't take very long before you start dancing around a golden calf. And that's exactly what's happening. We have become like the Israelites down below while Moses goes up to get the law, and they're dancing around a golden calf and having their orgies and having their free-for-alls and doing their, you know, and robbing from each other and violence and everything else that's going on. That's what's going on in our society. So we have gone from the rule of law, natural law, God's law, to social justice, which is the rule of man, which is anything goes. You go with your heart, man. You just do your thing. You be you, right? That's what we're being taught. And it's social justice. And if you don't follow the woke standard, then you're an enemy and you're going to be canceled and all this other garbage. And so we've gone from the rule of law to social justice. Number 13, from local energy to the Department of Energy. It's supposed to be that locally we generate what we need to generate. And if we need to work with other communities, we'll work with other communities and we'll set up our lines and all that. We have a federal government now that controls all of that. And because they control all of that and they've got their regulations regarding, you know, the power lines and things like that, then they believe that they've got even more say than they're supposed to have constitutionally. Well, how much say are they supposed to have constitutionally? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely no say. None. There's nothing in the Constitution that gives the federal government any authority over our power, the electricity, whatever you want to call it. And what's fascinating is as we go from local energy to Department of Energy, and then now they're starting to dictate how much we can use and then dictate, you know, what the emissions are, and then dictate, say, hey, you're not even using that. We're not going to let you use natural gas anymore. We're going to take this away from you. We can take that away from you. But don't worry. Go all electric. You know, and the all electric thing kind of cracks me up because I seem to remember as a kid, my parents taught me this, and I hope they taught, you know, your parents taught you something similar, was that when it came to your life, you don't put everything in one basket. You know, don't put all your eggs in one basket. You diversify. You know, in investments, the same thing. You're in whoever your financial advisor, your finance guy who helps you invest. And they'll tell you, don't put all of your eggs in one basket. Diversify, you know, have a few stocks here and a few bonds here and a couple of CD accounts or whatever it is they're going to tell you. And that's just common sense. And we've gone from, you know, basically a diversity of energy to, oh, everything's got to be electric. But don't worry, it'll hold together even though it won't. Don't worry, there won't be any problems even though there's definitely a possibility of problem. And what happens also when everybody's all electric and then they control it, right? And suddenly, because you can't put a fire, you can't put a log on your fireplace or in your, you know, wood burning oven, you can't, you know, burn your natural gas, you can't turn on your propane tank because everything's got to be electric and you don't have a gasoline powered car, so you got to charge every hour of driving. So if you got a 15 hour drive, it's now going to take you 30 hours because you got to stop every hour to charge for an hour. But don't worry, you're saving the planet and everything's electricity. All your eggs in one electricity basket. What happens when the power goes out? What happens when it's all done? What happens when a Carrington event happens, for example, like in, what was it? I think it was 1859 or something like that, where a, you know, plasma surge, you know, shot from the sun and it fried all the telegraph wires. What's it going to do to all our electricity? Suddenly, you're going to have a whole bunch of stuff that's not running. And guess what? If your money is also electronic because they went to digital, well, you don't have any money either. We're back to the Stone Age. But you know what could go wrong going all electric? We could go back to the Stone Age. Not a fan of it. So we've gone from local energy to Department of Energy, and the Department of Energy and all of the powers that be that works around it, environmentalism and all this other stuff, saying, guess what? You're going electric only. But don't worry. Even though you know that putting all your eggs in one basket is dangerous, it's not dangerous. We'll make sure it's okay. Yeah, because when has government ever failed you before, right? All right, number 14, from common defense to the military-industrial complex. Now, this is an interesting one because common defense really developed after the Revolutionary War. The defenses were individual defenses for the states, the state defense force, the militias. And the militias, that's really what started the beginning of the Revolutionary War. But the militias on their own were not adequate enough to fight the war for a number of reasons. Number one, the reality is in military operations, there needs to be a decision maker. There needs to be a central unifying force. Now, for us, that central unifying force was George Washington. But what wound up happening because of militias, you know, it's a voluntary force, man. You know, the fighting gets tough, they run for the hills. They're a bunch of volunteers. What do they care? They're not going to lose their enlistment. They're a militia. And so these militias, it was understood, was not what was going to win the war. We needed a more permanent force. We needed a constitutional army of regulars who had an enlistment. They were going through certain training. They were working together. They weren't going to run for the hills. And they fell under the central command of General George Washington. And that's what we had. And then, so when the Constitution was written, you know, rather than just have the militias, a military, a common defense would be formed. So the United States Army, United States Marine Corps, United States Navy, ultimately the Air Force, Coast Guard, and Space Force as well. That's beside the point. But what we have now is this military-industrial complex where the military has become such a huge monster, we fear it. The founding fathers feared a standing army being used against the people. Now we've got this huge military body that can be turned on the people. And they've talked about it. They've threatened it. And so it's a dangerous thing. Number 15, from committees of safety to homeland security. Committees of safety were committees that were formed in different communities that communicated with other communities. They worked together to keep the area safe, to communicate with each other, make sure the militias were operating, to pass on news about what was going on during the Revolutionary War or other operations. Committees of Safety was a basically local homeland security. So in other words, Homeland Security existed before Homeland Security Department of Homeland Security was invented. You know what it was called? Militias and Men with Guns. The right to keep and bear arms. That was Homeland Security. When the Patriot Act came out, and everybody was all upset, and I said, well, yeah, I don't even know why they created it. We already have a Patriot Act. It's called the Second Amendment. If everybody is walking around with a gun on their body, we're not going to have a problem with terrorism. We're not going to have a problem with an invasion because the average person can shoot the invader. That was the original Patriot Act, and it should be the only one, the Second Amendment. But nonetheless, we've gone from committees of safety, local security, guys taking care of business at home because they're men. Now, we don't have any men. All the men have been turned into women, it seems. And that's what worked to Homeland Security. Now we have this overarching agency that's going to dictate to us what we can or can't do in times of emergency. But don't worry, they'll keep you safe. What can go wrong? The government's here to help. If you remember the old Ronald Reagan quote, you know, the most fearful words in the English language is, we're from the government, we're here to help. All right, so that's number 15. Number 16, from fishing villages and frontier hunts to the Fish and Wildlife Service. Now think about this for a second. If you want to catch a fish, if you want to hunt an animal, you have to get a permit from the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they control stuff so tightly, or even limited on how many you could tag. Now, I understand the argument behind it. You know, overfishing, overhunting, you know, you destroy the ecology, you don't have enough for future generations to hunt and fish, whatever. I get that. And I do believe that there should be Fish and Wildlife Services, but it should be at the local level. It should be up to the local communities to take care of fishing standards in fishing villages and hunting standards in their area of the frontier. Now, if they're not doing a good job, then people say, well, then that's where the federal government should come in. Well, if that's the case, if we need a federal agency to do this, then we're going to need to have an amendment to the Constitution, because currently there's no authority, no power authorized through the Constitution for the federal government to be involved in fish and wildlife. It's not there. It doesn't exist. All right, now number 17, from indirect taxation to the Internal Revenue Service. Indirect taxation to the Internal Revenue Service. Indirect taxation, direct taxation was illegal. They could not tax you directly by the head, income tax like we have today. It had to be based on census and it had to be an indirect tax. In other words, the taxing agency has a middleman that they have to go through to get to you. They cannot tax you directly. But the middleman has been eliminated. Direct taxation is now completely legal. 16th Amendment basically allows it when it comes to income And Thomas Jefferson said that if ever the federal government would be able to directly tax, there would be no limit to how much they tax. And we've seen that. So indirect taxation to the Internal Revenue Service. The Internal Revenue Service, by the way, was created in 1862, long before the 16th Amendment, because Abraham Lincoln also put in an income tax, which he believed was needed in order to fund the war. But seeing it as illegal and unconstitutional, it was put out of commission, but then it returned again, the income tax, after the 16th Amendment. And that's what we're experiencing today. And so now we've got indirect taxation is gone, and we have the Internal Revenue Service. It's direct taxation. You better pay your taxes, or guess what? The IRS is going to come knocking on the door, and your agent, well, he has a gun on his hip. That's what we're up against in today's society. Number 18, from locally regulated businesses to mercantilism. What is mercantilism? This is what the British were doing. The British were committing mercantilism against the colonists. Now, what I mean by that is they're playing favorites. They were saying, okay, because your industry here in the colonies negatively influences the British merchants, we're not going to let you put yours to market. We're going to pick winners and losers, and we choose the British merchants. That's mercantilism. And that's now going on in America. You have certain companies that have favored status with the government. Government's bending over backwards to make sure certain corporations do well. They have the red light, the green light, while others have the red light, and they're killing smaller businesses currently because they don't like the free market system anyway. Remember, they're a bunch of socialist, communist jerks. But and so the free market, private enterprise, privately owned businesses, they're against it. And that's what's going on right now, is we have locally regulated businesses to mercantilism rather than the local government saying, okay, guys, if you want to have a business in our town, there's going to be a local city license, and we're going to check on your whatever practices, every 4 months or whatever. And the local government could do that. But there's no authority for the federal government to be involved in all of that. The federal government has no authority to dictate to businesses how they run their business or check up on them or any of that. Federal government has no business doing it. And what we have is federal intrusion has become mercantilism. We do have now the federal government picking winners and losers and saying, hey, if you do this manufacturing, then our favored business over here can't, so you can't do it. We're not going to allow it. We're going to shut it down. And unfortunately, that has become the norm, and we're okay with it because we got all kinds of excuses why to accept it. Well, gosh, Doug, don't you know that? This and that, and we have to make sure this happens, make sure that. I get that all the time. I hear that all the time from people. The problem is we are convinced that all things have to go through the federal government for it to work. If the federal government doesn't have some, iron fist out on some way, it's just not going to work right. As if the states are not capable of properly regulating at the local level. All right, now we're going to go from, number 19. From execution of the law to federal enforcement agencies. So I was talking earlier about how the militia was the agency that was supposed to execute the laws. And the job of the president is to execute the laws, not enforce the laws. He is not law enforcement, he's law execution. And there's not supposed to be very many laws locally. Domestically, the federal government has almost no authority. And so the very idea that we have federal enforcement agencies, the FBI and the FDA and the ATF and so on and so forth, and it's mind-boggling. Who gave them that authority? It's none of their authority. Well, gosh, Doug, don't you want your drugs to be properly regulated and have this happen and that happen and this could go wrong and that could go wrong? We can't trust the states. Well, if that's the case, then get a constitutional amendment and add the power. Otherwise, it's up to the states. And, be honest with you, before all these federal agencies existed, we were doing just fine. The United States of America was operating just fine. All right, number 20, from log cabins to housing and urban development. Now, I'm not saying that there shouldn't be standards for building homes and developing and all this other stuff. But we have gone too far, A. And number two, once again, the federal government doesn't have the authority. That should be up to each state on how they want to do it. It's funny because I have a friend of mine who used to be on a local city council here in where I live here in Southern California, and he moved to a different state. I think it was Tennessee. And because he's used to, you know, because he's on city council, so he's used to Southern California, you know, and what we do here in the state and what we demand and all sort of stuff. And he goes to them and says, hey, you know, I'm thinking about doing this on my property. What permits do I need to get? And they're like, it's your property. Do what you want. He says, well, what if I do this? Don't I need a permit for such and such? They're like, no, you know, it's your property. Do what you want on your property. Well, what if I want to do this or I want to do that on my property? What permits do I need to get for that? So, sir, you it's your property. Do what you want with it. And then they finally, after so many questions, say, well, you're from California, aren't you? It is ridiculous that we have so many rules. I get it. I understand how we don't want things falling down. We want to make sure that things aren't so cheaply made that people are hurt and that it's not good for the community or whatever. But that's none of the federal government's business. That's up to local discretion. And if you're in a rural area, who cares how you build your log cabin or whatever? That's up to you. And the government, even the local government, shouldn't have much business involved. Meanwhile, I've got some property up there on the Oregon coast, man, and you can't put in a shed without them freaking out and doing this sample and that sample and this test and that test, just to make sure that you're not affecting, you know, particular watershed or whatever. Once again, I'm not saying that we go the opposite extreme and that there's no regulations, but this housing and urban development, this federal control over everything, this iron fist that comes down on housing and development and all of that jazz, very unconstitutional, and it's ridiculous the way it is. Once again, I'm not saying it should be the opposite extreme and be none. I do think there should be some local regulation to a certain extent. But where we have these rules that go way beyond what they're supposed to be, they're very intrusive, and there's federal funding behind it, or the federal government has a say in it, or whatever, it's all unconstitutional and it all shouldn't happen. All right, that's just the first 20. Now remember, I have over 100 of these that I came up with this morning before I started recording. 114 of them, to be exact. I've gone through the first 20, and I spent a whole hour kind of rapid-firing through them. We are living in a society where we are overregulated. The federal government is operating in a manner that's outside the Constitution. That said, I'm out of time, so let's end the show. My name is Douglas V. Gibbs, douglasvgibbs.com. Become a patron. Join the site. Hit the join link, $9 a month. My newest book, History book, is out. Find it on Amazon. A Promise of Truth Self-Evident, Part 1, Early American History, is out. So go there to check that out. And also, United We Stand, Combined We Kick Butt. God bless America, my friends. God bless you. We'll see you next week right here on KPRZ. Thank you for spending the time. Bye-bye.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.